Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Andre, and we just want to say welcome to our session today. Today we'll be talking about the concepts of poverty and wealth. What does that mean for folks? How has the system been set up, and how do we break free of that mindset of poverty, and how do we develop wealth? And so our essential question is, why are people poor? And on today's show, we will have some folks call in that are experts in dealing with issues regarding diversity and how we help change people's mindsets. So I want to first, you know, give a brief introduction of myself and what I do in the organizations that I work for. So I am and I don't like this word, and you'll see why as we have conversations, but I am a diversity trainer or a consultant or in some ways an organizational coach around diversity issues. And I particularly don't care for the word, you know, diversity, because I believe that it's kind of like when I was in college, I had a roommate, and we had decided, Donald Payton and I decided to kind of move in together. We were good friends. And so we decided that one of the rules of the house would be that everyone would do their own dish. So I don't know if you've been with college age guys or have hung out with you know, these young men, but that particular plan of action was not necessarily the best one for us. Because by saying that, you know, everyone will do their own dish, it became very obvious that no one was going to do the dishes because everyone was responsible. I think the same thing happens when we talk about diversity stuff, that it's so vast and so encompassing of so many things that it's very difficult to make sure that we have we've given direction, that we've given responsibility, that we've given matrix, that we've given benchmarks to individuals to make sure that diversity efforts work and that they last. And so I find that word diversity problematic, because when you say diversity, are you talking about the current racial construct that we've built? Are you talking about access to goods, jobs, and services from varying parts of our society? Are you talking about, you know, sexual orientation or the ideological orientation that one has? Are you talking about the religious aspects? And I would say that all of those things can encompass what it means to talk about diversity, but it also becomes very difficult when we're having a conversation and we believe that the words mean different things. For example, if I were a math teacher and I gave my students a number of math problems, and let's say one of those problems is, you know, 1 + 1 equals what? The expectation is that they would say 2. I can be guaranteed that they understand once we have a common language, and that they know that 1 + 1, particularly in my class, will always equal 2. Now, there are those who say you know, there are other math equations that can prove different things. But as an elementary math teacher, that concept is extremely important for me to get across to my students. And so so when we talk about diversity, a lot of times, you know, people say 2 plus 2 equals 6, or some people say 2 plus 2 equals 4, and some people say 2 plus 2 equals 5, and I can prove it to you. But again, I think using that word diversity becomes problematic when we don't have a common definition of what it is that we're actually talking about. So as a diversity trainer, and I have to use those words so that other people can know what I'm talking about, I spend a lot of time with organizations and with individuals talking about and working with how do we change our paradigm, the way we see the world, in a way that makes us as individuals more effective and also adds value to the organizations that we serve. So my focus in talking about diversity issues, I talk a lot about cultural competence, both of the organization as well as the members or the people, the individuals in the organization, and how do we gain, using a matrices, using a set of guidelines and principles, how do we move along this continuum of behavior to get to a place that we actually can give our best to our organizations and allow other people to give their best in organizations. The way that an individual thinks actually impacts the way that they live. And so I think it's important that in organizations that we look at the culture. Why is it that our organizations, oftentimes I'll get called into organizations, and one of their core questions is, why are we a white organization? And or how do we get more people from diverse backgrounds into our organization? And one of the questions that I ask is this something that you really want to do? And obviously people say yes, because that's definitely the political correct response to give is, of course I want my organization to be so and so and so and so. And they said, well, you know, and often in these conversations, I will, you know, drill down and ask about our policies and procedures. And how is it that our policies and procedures are helping us get to what we want to do, quote unquote? And I find it interesting that sometimes people don't necessarily get it. So, for example, there is a practice that often happens in workplaces that's interesting at best, because it seems logical, and a lot of times we try to use logic to help us solve our problems, but it actually creates more problems when we use logic as opposed to looking at our values and making sure that we stick with our values. So, for example, a lot of workplaces will talk about this seniority. And seniority can sometimes be very problematic in the workplace, especially if you're trying to achieve some kind of diversity or cultural competence or inclusion goals, because what seniority says is that if you've been here a long time, then you've earned some certain rights. No matter if you're effective or if you're ineffective, if you know what you're doing or you don't know what you're doing, typically what happens is seniority says, you know, you've been here long enough that those other things don't matter as much as your physical presence in this organization. And what people find is, when times get tough, when the economy dips, when people are fearful in their consumption of goods and products, that profits of organizations go down, they start looking at ways to trim or refit, resize, right size, downsize their organization. And when They go to their policies and procedures. It's made sense to say that we'll do seniority. And so in organizations that have been predominantly white for a significant amount of time, when it comes to that seniority stuff, what typically happens is that the people or the newcomers to that organization are at the bottom of the list, and the people who have been there for a long time are at the top of the list. And so what ends up happening is that women and people of color and other groups that haven't been a part of the American system as fluidly as other groups find themselves at the bottom of the list. And so when they start chopping off pieces of the list or individuals, those individuals who are women and people of color who've not been a part of the system for a very long time kind of get lopped off. And so our organizations go back to being what they were before. And then some other initiative comes in, a new immigrant group moves into our communities. We have these think tanks and all these things, and we start hiring again until we have the next budgetary crisis. And so the system continues, and as that continues, we continue to see our organizations maintain how they were originally established. And so part of what I do is I try to engage people in different ways so that we can talk about, you know, do we want to use a seniority system, knowing that there will be people in that system that may not be the best people for the job or may be outshined by someone else. So we want to encourage organizations to at least think about a value system approach to its staffing and hiring and firing of individuals. So that's very important. So the way people think is so important to the way they live that we spend a lot of time really just working with organizations and working with individuals about their perceptions of the world. I was asked just the other day in an interview, what was a time or name a time when, you know, you faced blatant discrimination or blatant racism? And one of the things that I laughed about is that I face that every day. And I know people are like, oh, yeah, that's right, I do too. Or other folks are like, there's no way you could do that. My take on that is just because I face it doesn't mean I have to accept it. And so what that means for me is that I have every day plenty of opportunities to be upset, to be disgruntled, to blame who I used the person I used to call the man for a lot of things. And I could be and I feel, and I think others might also see some of those instances as being legitimate for me being upset. And so I know that it's important that I not get upset every time one of those things happens, because I also understand that people are doing the best they can with what they have. Many of the tools have been inadequate for the job that needs to be done. And so I can beat people up because they have poor tools, or I can help them use the tools they have effectively or give them new tools. And so, yeah, there are instances all the time where I could be upset or angry about an interaction that I had with an individual or groups of individuals. But if I don't help them, it's important for me to be a helpful person in those situations. So So it's important to be a helpful person in those situations. As a diversity consultant and trainer and organizational coach, the other thing that's extremely important to think about in terms of how organizations work and interact with the outside community is that oftentimes looking at organizations' affirmative action plans and looking at their, you know, diversity and inclusion goals, we'll find that there are some aggressive actions that organizations say we want to increase our goal for, you know, outreach and achieve these goals for this, that, and the other thing. And they are very aggressive and looking to really build their organizations. One of the things that we need to be mindful of is the fact that although sometimes those goals are, you know, at the top level and we hope that they'll trickle down, a lot of times our diversity efforts stop and start with the hiring manager. And one of the things that I've often heard in some of the organizations that I've worked with is that hiring managers will use this phrase after the fact, not prior to, not as a part of a standardized approach, but after the fact, hiring managers will say that this person that we just interviewed is not the right fit. I don't know if you've ever heard that before or heard some of your colleagues talk about that, but they'll say that this person is not the right fit. And so I have begun a crusade to really challenge the managers that I work with and the supervisors that I work with to really identify and tease out what do they mean by this right fit. Because it seems a very convenient way to not hire someone, or to a very valid way to an accepted way to deny someone the access to goods, jobs, services, and money based on an individual's perception of their ability. And so one of the things that I've started asking supervisors and managers when I hear those things is, okay, let's talk about the right fit. And what does that mean to you? And then what does that mean for the organization? Because ultimately what we want are two categories of people. So when we say the right fit, it's my belief that that people need to fit into one of these two categories. They need to be able to help us maintain the status quo, which means they need to help us stay exactly where we are today. And so these would be kind of like the worker ants. These are the people who do the day in and day out kind of activities that have always been carried out. So, you know, we talk about this right fit. Do employees, you know, fit into being able to do those rudimentary job categories? I mean, is it just basic stuff? Is it the stuff that helps us maintain who we currently are? So so that's the first part in terms of this right fit concept. The second part is, do these individuals, do this person coming to my organization applying for a job, do they fit into the second category? And the second category is someone who expands our ability to do our work. All right. So we have the individual who keeps us at the status quo, and we also have the individual that expands our capacity to do work. And so here's an example of an interaction that I had with a supervisor. There was a job posting for a position kind of entry-level job. And there had been a temp, a person that was a temporary employee that had been there for about 2 years as a temporary employee, knew the job well. This job would move them to a full-time job. And if they did not get the job, they would still maintain their part-time status. So there was some incentive for them to move to full-time position. And so the supervisors interviewed this person, found that they were adequate, liked what they had to offer, and they were the number one candidate. And so I looked at the list, and I asked about the number two candidate because their score was about two percentage points away from the first candidate, which, you know, when you talk about two percentage points, they're almost identical. Although there's a, you know, there's a little bit of difference, but for the most part, all of their things were identical. And so I looked at the number two candidate. The scores were about the same. The experiences were about the same. But I did see something interesting about the second candidate, which was that they spoke two languages. And in that particular organization, there was an influx of refugees and immigrants that the organization currently did not have capacity to serve at its best. It couldn't serve them the way it would like to. And so one of the things that I started asking is, of these two, the number one and the number two, which increases our capacity to serve our clients and which maintains the status quo? It wasn't my job to, you know, make a decision for that supervisor or manager, but it was my job to help them think differently about how to engage our clients and our community. And so the supervisor looked at the number one candidate and the number two candidate and decided that the number two candidate actually expanded their capacity to do work. So I like the fact that oftentimes if we look at the rudimentary systems that we've put in place, that when we look at how we've done business in the past, it's very easy for us to look at those systems as logical systems, to say this stuff makes sense, when in fact they sometimes act contrary to our goals and our objectives as practitioners. And so as a diversity trainer, that's one of the things that I get really excited about, when people can think about what's best as opposed to being stuck in the roots of tradition, as Henry David Thoreau would describe those things. So we spend a lot of time working with our organizations about how they can think differently and how effectively they can interact with the communities that they serve, because ultimately that's what they want to do. So I just want to talk briefly about the topic today, which is poverty and wealth, and why are people poor. And I typically start this conversation off with the inverse of that question: why are rich people rich? And typically, when I ask that question, people get kind of thrown back, but they can come up with some answers because their parents are rich, because they inherited money, because of all of these things. And so, I typically ask the follow up question: were they born rich? I mean, of their own. You know, are there things that they of themselves as small babies have done to earn them riches? And typically the answer is no. And so I ask one more question: then how do rich babies become rich people? And the answer typically evolves or revolves around the discussion about how they were taught to be rich. And so I giggle and I think about their responses, because if rich people are taught to be rich, and who teaches rich people how to be rich? Other rich people. And so it would go to follow that line of logic, and we ask the question, why are people poor? It becomes very obvious to us why people are poor, and that is because they have been what? Taught to be poor. And who has taught them how to be poor? Other poor people. In most situations, it's been their family system that's taught them those values and taught them those behaviors. It could be their educational system that has taught them those values and taught them that behavior. It is, and oftentimes it's reinforced by our social norms and our social way of being in our society that, fast money is good money, and the better you make it, and the more things you can, the more externalities you can create where other people pay for your stuff, the better you are. It's so funny. I remember hanging out with New York Knicks, and there was a youth camp that I was working with, and it was just amazing when we would go to clubs in New York, how the individual I was hanging out with made well over, and this was back in the 90s, but made well over, $300,000. But we were going into these nightclubs and didn't have to pay one dime. And I would look at, the regular Joes, and they were, they were forking out tons of bucks just to hang out. So a big part of why people are rich and why they're or wealthy and why people are in poverty has to do with their education. And later in one of our shows, we'll talk about assets and liabilities and how particularly poor people or people in poverty have mistaken assets for liabilities and liabilities as assets. For example, a home, is a home an asset or a liability? For my grandfather in his time, his home was an asset because it would make him some money. It would add to his portfolio of value. It would increase his net worth. To ask that question today, is a home an asset or a liability? I would argue that a house is a liability in that our American system of buying and living in homes is such that every 5 years or so or 7 years, it seems as though we're looking for a new home because the toys that we've bought and the things that we've accumulated no longer fit our lifestyle in that home that we purchased. And so I would argue that we don't buy homes anymore. We actually buy mortgages, and we try to trade mortgages for a better mortgage or reduce our mortgage, but never seem to be satisfied in staying in one place long enough to get the benefits of having an asset. And cars are another example. Is a car an asset or a liability? And I would say that it is, in fact, a liability. So in our future shows, we hope that you join us. We'll have more conversations about these.
GEICO presents Sharing versus Oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. GEICO has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.